Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Colin Ray Jackson, CBE. No strange name in the middle there. Often strange names in the middle there. Born the 18th of February 1967 in Cardiff, Wales. What was life for you growing up in Cardiff?
Absolutely heaven. I was one of these kind of mischievous little boys, and I loved being in so much open space. I had lots of woodlands around me, so I spent many of the years with friends and family playing games, literally playing games, jumping streams, seeing who could run the fastest between lampposts, playing bulldogs. I spent a lot of time enjoying being in Wales. So it was a really special time for me, that's for sure.
Your dad, Aussie, and your mum, Angela, they'd come from the Caribbean. Your mum's a nurse, your dad...
Yeah, my father was we kind of called him a sales supervisor it was like an air conditioning company called New Air. And they were fantastic, actually, as a little company for him to work with as well. So, yeah, we had a great stable background.
Okay, and you've got one sister, and I'm sorry to say, I never made the connection, but of course, once the research for this program, I mean, it's just possible, Colin, that in your own house, you're not the most famous person. Is that possible?
Yeah, it's very, very, very true. I mean, my sister's been on the TV every Saturday night for 10 or 11 years now.
Your
in Casualty.
Is, yeah. Is the actress Suzanne Packer, who plays Tess Bateman in Casualty. Before that, she was Josie in Brookside. She's been on, I mean, you're on television quite a lot. I mean, you can't get your face off of television. But she's on every weekend for the past 25 years.
And it's, of course, scary.
Once I realised this fact, excuse me, and saw her, it would be impolite to say she looks just like you. Let's just say you look just like her, yeah?
Because she's older than me. That's the reason why we're saying that. We'll keep that between us, right?
But, are you close?
Oh, we're very close. Yeah. Absolutely.
And
very,
competitive
very
about TV time and all that?
No, never, ever, ever. I think one of the things we've never been ever is competitive about anything. I take a lot of advice from my sister. I think she's most probably the wisest person on this planet, so I respect her highly.
Well, that's good luck for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, she'd be one of the people I would choose as a friend. And so I'm lucky that she's actually my sister too.
Right.
So it's a nice relationship that we have.
Has she ever given you advice about your work on the television?
Always, always. And some of the key things is how to present things, how to learn scripts, etc., etc.
Okay.
Because
so
she's
actually
been
useful
for a long time. Yeah.
Not just comb it. Just say, do your shirt off.
Oh, no. She would never say that because she knows I'll tell her off. But the real practical hands-on stuff, it's brilliant to have a coach literally next year.
What about a sport? Because I think you just mentioned that you were a very active child. I mean, hilarious now that a generation on, we have to organise TV events in order to get kids to be active. But I think it is actually a problem in society now. Not for you. I take it, given that I saw a thing about a biopsy did on your body, and you've got 25% twitch fibres, fibres, way above the human norm. I take it you're very good at sport at school.
I was all right. Yeah. I was all right. Yeah, no, the fast twitch muscles is quite funny because I have 25% extra, like more super, they call it super fast twitch muscles, which gives me an advantage. I have no idea what they're talking about.
Well, I would think you'd be very good at jumping, and it turns out you were pretty good at jumping.
I was pretty good at that. But sport was my life, I must admit, from the early days. I loved running, I loved jumping.
Did you bother at school?
Yes, I had no choice. There was a time when I was not really concentrating too much on my schoolwork, and my mother stopped me doing all my sport.
Spot on. I mean, I'm sorry. Of course you must encourage your kids to do sport as well. But but the number of people who sat in that chair where you're sat now and just told me, oh, I didn't bother at school. And they've all done very well in their own field. And then you ask them the question very quietly 20 minutes later, do you regret not doing well at school? And over half of them just say, of course I do. You know, I'm sitting here.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing I most probably regret the most of my school days was that I didn't take languages seriously. Never did I think I would spend so much time travelling around the world. It would have been so much handier to learn French and Spanish and German.
But that's nothing to do with you or the schools. That's this country, isn't it? We just don't. I mean, we have the unbelievable good luck.
Of course.
The light of good luck shines on us that we speak English to start with. But that is pure chance, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Were you one of these people who had athletics heroes or sports heroes?
Yes. Don Quarry was mine from...
The great Jamaican sprinter.
Because I remember... Absolutely, my parents screaming at the TV when he was racing at the Olympic Games, 72 and 76. And I was thinking, what were they screaming at? And I could see the effect that his successes were having on them. And I thought, oh, I wouldn't mind a bit of that. So it was great to have him as an initial kickoff as a role model. And then once I started getting into the sport a little bit more, there was only one man for me, and it was Daley Thompson.
Okay. I mean, you're starting with a big personality there, aren't you?
I love the fact that he'd won everything. I think that was the key factor. He'd won everything, he achieved everything, but he still had a little bit of an edge about him, which I absolutely adored. His cheeky smile that always won it for me.
You played cricket for Glamorgan at school. You did all kinds of long jump, hurdles, high jump, even the javelin. Why did you choose athletics, and how did you become a hurdler?
Okay, the reason I chose athletics is simple. I was very lazy. There was an athletics and a cricket match exactly on the same day, and one was for Glamorgan, the other one was for Cardiff, the city, and the athletic competition was literally 5 minutes walk from my house, and the actual cricket match was a 3-hour drive. So I decided I'm taking the walk, and I never played cricket ever
again.
Do you
regret that?
No. I see you've got a piece of paper with a couple of my medals I've won. I don't think I could ever regret it.
No, the danger, as I say, I'm going to tell you now this, so put them into the and warn the listeners. The danger, this could become, it seems unlikely given that your personality, but it could become a rather boring program. So we just talked about the medals you've won. Of course, you are, let's be honest, Colin, you've won more medals than any other British athlete, in gold, silver, and bronze across. Yeah. It gets into the mid 20s. So we can't just do every race that you came first or second in at all.
Yeah, it would be dull.
Let me ask you one more question before to take a little time off. You had to, very early in this piece, you chose to be coached by a man called Malcolm Arnold, who is a phenomenally... But you made that choice as a teenager. How did that come about? 15,
yeah. I saw him right in the middle of a corridor, and somebody pointed me out and saying, this guy's the national coach for Wales, and if you really want to do anything, it's this guy you should speak to. And I thought, well... He didn't look really all that, but if people are giving me good advice, then I'll go and see him. So I went over and I introduced myself to him, and he really didn't say that much, if I was totally honest. I didn't think he expected too much from me. And we just worked together forever and ever. Amen.
Well, hopefully the miracle of radio will allow us to speak to Malcolm a little later on. But you actually, I mean, this is the world before athletes were earning a full-time living and just from saying, I'm an athlete, give me a grant. You had a job.
I had to. I trained to be an electrician, funny enough. Two of my uncles were electricians, and I kind of liked their lifestyle. And I thought to myself, I think I'll be able to train up and be an electrician myself. So,
what do you mean you like their lifestyles?
Well, they seem to be living quite a nice life. They seem to be going on holidays left, right, and centre. And I thought, well, this seems to work. So, I thought, let's give myself a little bit of a trade and give me, I guess, a bit of a fighting chance out there.
Okay, and because you know what, obviously you didn't know you were going to be the success you turned out to be. But at 18, you make the decision to become a full-time athlete, to quit the athletics. You've already talked about your family, and clearly you had a very happy upbringing. You're close, and your sister is the wisest woman in the world. What did they say when you said, I'm packing this in now to become an athlete?
They weren't particularly happy, especially my parents were like, are you sure you could do this? Because you can imagine in those days, they didn't have professional track and field athletes. So what do you mean you're going to give up your work to actually try and do well at this sport? And they gave me a deadline, and they said by the age of 21, if you've made it, then that's fantastic. But if you haven't, at least it gives you the opportunity to go back into the world. So they decided that they were going to fund me and look after me.
They supported you, did they?
Yeah.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah. They didn't need to for very long, though.
No.
Luckily for them.
No, quite. I mean, And did Malcolm Arnold, your coach, having joined you, did he encourage you in this?
No. He wanted me to continue in my career as well, to make sure that I had something to fall back on.
Sure.
For a plain reason. I mean, they were looking after me for my livelihood.
Yeah.
You know, they were unsure what I could do. Nobody really knew what I was like, whether I was going to be able to adapt to training, whether I was going to enjoy it. So it was a huge risk for them and me, I guess.
Okay. There was also, I think, one last question about, because you were such an all-rounder.
Mm.
There was some talk about you being a decathlete at one stage. Now, you've already said I was lazy, so I'm beginning to think that's probably not a starter.
I loved it, because decathlon for me was like play. So I was like, yeah, let's just play with all these sports and all these different events. But I was very injury-prone as well when I was young, and because I would suffer from little aches and pains, and because I'm quite short for an athlete. And because of that, then decathlon could not be for me.
Well, compared to some of the hurdlers who you had to compete against and have... Certainly the ones who've come along since, you're pretty short. Yeah, not a small... Although, you're not built for the throwing events, really.
I had a very fast arm.
Oh,
and I was
right.
Very good technically.
Okay.
So because I could get a grasp of the technique quite quickly, you know, with a little bit of strength training, I could get it a reasonable way. You don't have to throw it very far.
I'm determined not to let this show just wander off into mad tributaries, because we've got so much to get through. But I have to ask you, Jessica Ennis, obviously the best decathlete in the world, we saw that at the Olympics. She is a tiny little person.
She's tiny. Yeah.
People tell me they think that she can really hurdle fast.
Yeah. I mean she's a British record holder for that.
Already. I mean, do you think if she was to concentrate on the hurdles, how fast could she go, do you think?
Well, I think her heptathlon preparation really helps her with the hurdling itself.
Okay.
So if she kind of took away half of the training, and adapted to the hurdle, she may not absolutely go.
Suspicion is she's as quick as she's going to be?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
But what I think she should do is have a go at the 400-meter hurdles.
Right.
She's very good at the sprint hurdles, and she's got a great 200 and 800-meter speed. So I think if she coupled the two of them, Sally Gunnell's British record could be under threat.
And there, of course, her lack of physical stature is slightly less of an issue, isn't it?
Absolutely, because she's short, and so are the hurdles.
Yeah. They're in scale then, aren't they? Listen, let's talk about, I mean, your gamble of leaving your trade, you're right, it didn't take long before you started to pay off for you, because you really made very quick progress, yeah. Colin. I mean, I think that's fair to say. So I should ask you about the first time you competed against seniors was the 1985 European Indoor Championships in Athens, of course, 60 metres.
Yeah.
First, let me ask you about that. 60 metres hurdles, it's one of the most hilarious events, because it's over very quickly and you've still got to do all that technical stuff. Do you like running indoors?
I hated it. I absolutely hated it, for that sole reason, because you're still under a lot of pressure. You take the very first hurdle, you've only got four left, and people are around you, it's crowding you, it's busy. Oh, goodness gracious. And I always used to get persuaded to get in there and run it. Hated them. Absolutely.
What do you remember about Athens then and running it, that one?
Well, bizarrely enough, it was the first championships, you said, I went in as a senior, and it was the only championships where I never made a final as a senior. It was the only one in Athens, and I remember reflecting, and
fifth out of six in the semi-final, says here in my copious notes,
looking down at the final race where Nigel Walker from Great Britain and John Ridgen from Great Britain were lining up, and I was thinking to myself, see, I should be in that final. And I thought,
Ridgen's 5 days older than you, so you're exactly contemporary with him.
Absolutely.
And Nigel was Welsh, yeah?
Welsh, he trained with me. I was in the same training group as Nigel. So,
and did he go on to play rugby as well, at a very high level? Yeah.
He was a wing for Wales. Yeah. So
that is a brilliant career, isn't it?
It wasn't bad, actually.
I must get him in the studio, because that's a great story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very rare. Yeah. Very, very rare, especially with Vanessa's training partners. We were trying to persuade him not to do rugby, funny enough.
Fifth in the semi-final, in which one of the people makes the final is an exact contemporary. We'll hear more about John Ridgen as this programme goes on. In my notes, it says here that you were humiliated. Is that the right word, you think?
I kind of felt so, yeah, because I really thought that I was as good as John at that time, and I'm thinking there's only, you know, tiny millimeters between us performance wise and I thought I will never ever feel like this again, so I will not be sitting in a stand when a major hurdle final is taking place. So that was my very last time.
And you know what? And we'll hear about the an injury affected semi-final. You never lost another semi-final in your long, and in the end, it went on forever, your career. But you know, that's before the dancing started. We could not pry you off the television screen, Colin. You won your first major medal in the 110 meters European Junior Championships in Cottbus in East Germany. where you equal the Welsh national record. I think John Ridgeon beat you there as
well. Yes, he did.
So in a danger. So I need to skip forward, if I may, to the World Junior Championship the following year in Athens in 86. Where you continue to improve, but I suppose by the time you go there, you're favourite to win, aren't you? Is that fair?
Yeah, I had a strange winter because obviously I'd run very well the previous year, but I was beaten by John. So, and I was going to the World Junior Championships, and he was going to be at the World Junior Championships also. So there's going to be another head to head. It was going to be very competitive.
I should tell the listeners, for those of them who are not quite as nuts about athletics as I am, the World Junior and European Junior Championships are very important because, unlike, say, in football, where the people in the under 21 team don't always come through to play in the seniors, what goes on in the junior World Junior Athletics and Europe, it tends to be 2 years later they are the gold medalists in the Olympics and the World Championships. It's just the
absolutely.
Way it is, isn't it?
I mean, Usain Bolt was winning World Junior titles when he was 15, so we all know he is now.
Yes, we do. He's the saviour of global athletics. It's exactly what
we'll get to that.
He is
a superstar. But I knew it was very important that I performed well. But again, it was one of these things when injury was kind of just getting the better of me at the wrong moment, unfortunately. But I lined up in there knowing I was capable of running very, very quickly indeed. And when I actually won that title, I was so pleased. And when I saw the clock as well, I'd taken John's European Junior record, which did put a big smile on my face also. It just meant that I was the Britain's number one.
Indeed you were, and it means you're going to the next year and we come up against two things here, your Welshness and a man called Mark McCoy, Canadian gentleman who turns out to be your lifelong friend, training partner, all the rest of it. First of all, 86 Commonwealth Games were in Edinburgh, and you represented Wales, as people do. And that's one of the wonderful things about the Commonwealth Games, the GB team and Northern Ireland team breaks up into four parts. I mean, there's no reason why you should be especially proud of being Welsh or not. I'm just wondering where you stand on your Welshness.
I enjoyed being Welsh because it gives you something a little bit different. It's a little bit more of an edge. And I always used to think that people should know that I'm Welsh more than I'm English because they would always presume I was English. So when anybody presumes something, I would just wanted to remind them, actually, you're wrong. I am Welsh.
Once they hear that, I guess they're going to make a pretty wild guess, aren't they?
Absolutely. So it's great. So I always loved representing Wales. Always.
You have been the Welsh Sports Personality of the Year three times in your life. In many ways, I'm surprised there's as little as that. But of course, this year in particular, you'll be struggling to get into the top three. It's been an incredible year between Gareth Bale, Nathan Cleverley, Welsh rugby team. I could go on and on and on. It's been incredible.
It's been unbelievable.
The open top bus must be worn out down there in Cardiff.
We've only got one.
Yeah, of course. You don't usually need more than one,
exactly.
Do you?
And it's very
often
small.
It stays in the garage for a whole long time.
But it's been a sensational time for Welsh sport. And for me, what I've loved about it, because sport is something that really can unify people. And it can give people a real sense of pride when people that you live next door to have been so successful on a global scale or even a national scale. It makes a huge difference to the general temperament and feel of a nation. So it's been pretty sensational. I have no idea who's going to be Welsh Team of the Year. Is it going to be Cardiff for going up, Swansea for winning the Cup, the Welsh Team winning the Six Nations? Who is it going to be?
Newport.
Yeah, of course.
Getting back into the league after a quarter of a century.
It's just unbelievable, isn't it?
I would cancel that event for this year just because you're going to look churlish no matter which way you turn. I mean, and you got a silver in those Commonwealth Games behind a man called Mark McCoy. Tell it, because he is going to play a big part in your life. Tell us about Mark.
Yeah, no, Mark was one of these cool characters. You know, he'd go on the line, he was always chewing gum. He just was just super cool. But he was also very, very talented. He was a great sprinter. I just love watching what he was doing technically, how he worked out. It was just brilliant. But certainly those games, I knew he was definitely the man. You know, there was nothing I could do. I just had to watch, admire, and think, okay, one day I'll be as good as him. And he went on. He set a new championship record, and I came home second. I can't complain.
How did you come to be, and in the end, his training partner? Did he come to these islands, or
This is a bizarre story. My sister, he gave me a card of his when he was competing in London for one of the Grand Prix. And my sister was going to work on tour in Toronto. So I gave my sister his card. And she rang up this number.
She's bold.
Yeah, well, she's an actress, right?
Yeah, fearless, yeah. Right?
So she rang up Mark's number. He was not in that office. And somebody overheard the conversation, who said, I know where he is. This is, I'll take that call. They took the call. And they got in contact with Mark. So it was really a truncated route of getting there. Eventually, my sister then met up with him. They went out, they hung out, they had a good laugh and joke. My sister said, you should come back to Britain and train with Colin. And Mark was like, well, okay, well, if he doesn't mind. So he rang.
Easily led, isn't he?
Absolutely. See what women can do?
Yeah.
And then Lexi, you know, he's turning up at the airport and there we go. He's training with us for forevermore, as it seemed.
Okay, well, listen, you've got that silver medal for Wales. And I think we're getting into not the era of professional athletics yet, but I think you've got an upgrade in your sponsored car from a Ford Orion to a Ford Sierra. Now you're living.
Absolutely. And in those days, you know, I was chocolate. You can imagine, I was a 19-year-old boy, and boy, oh boy, my car, the wheels were just brilliant to have at that stage.
Are you bothered about cars?
I would say no.
Right.
But everybody else would say, look what you've owned. And I was thinking, well, perhaps it. Yeah,
and to use the jargon of Mendon, what are you driving today?
I drive a Jaguar car.
Okay, good for you. Yeah. But I want to talk about the 87 World Championships in Rome. I'll just give out the result, if you like. Jonathan Ridgen beat you, so he's back now beating you.
Absolutely.
But you both finished behind, I mean, a truly great man. Greg Foster was a great, great man. I've never met him. I don't know what kind of human being he is, but just watching him monster his way over those hurdles, something about his appearance makes you think he's probably a very good guy as well. I don't know.
He's a man mountain, that is. Yeah, yeah. And he was very good technically as well. If you wanted to watch somebody technically over the barrier, you could learn a lot from Greg. But yeah, it was the World Championships. It was 1987. And I was literally at the beginning of that season again, was ravaged by lots of injury problems. And I was literally living on aspirin and paracetamol going into those championships because I had a really bad problem with a hamstring insertion. And I could never get any fluency in my running. And so I was surprised, as many other people were.
Hang on, why aspirin? Because that's what you're allowed to take, is that it?
But basically, yeah. One for pain and one for anti-inflammatory.
Okay, right.
So you kind of combine the two. But it was a tough time. And I didn't expect to win a bronze medal there at all, because I knew my season, was so affected by injury. But to announce yourself... Yeah, in the world of sport,
with all due respect to winning a medal for Wales in the Commonwealth, this is you saying, here I am now on the world stage.
Absolutely.
And of course it changes things like financially. I think you suddenly start getting a load of appearance money and stuff like that.
Yeah, straight away. It's instant in the world of athletics. So if soon as you become a global medalist, you go from like £800 a race to nearly £5,000 straight away.
Which, if you're a sprinter and can turn out quite often, it's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. And when you think of what the money status was in those days, because we're talking about 1987, so you know, £5,000 was a lot of money, and especially for me as a 20-year-old who 2 years ago was still at school.
Yeah, but it's still not Mo Farah getting $750,000, not even finished the race, is it though? Let's be honest.
Yeah, but he's working a lot harder than I was, right?
that is very fair to say. I mean, that's 87, which takes us then, I mean, you arrive in 1988, and the Seoul Olympics, you're 21 years of age, you're arguably one of the best in the world, and you've got both this Olympics and a whole range of Olympic Games ahead of you to become Olympic champion. You've also taken up here, if that's the right word, with Linford Christie.
Yes.
You shared a room. Were Linford and you put together, or did you choose Linford?
No, it was bizarre because there was always this little London thing that was going on down here, and Linford was kind of a West London boy, so he was isolated on his own. The hub of sprinting was from North London, so he was literally isolated. So, you know, I was Welsh, and so I was isolated, so it was two boys all isolated together. There you go.
West London is nearer to Wales than North London. That's just loony, isn't it? Who were the North Londoners who wouldn't let him play nicely?
Well, it'd be people like Mike McFarlane were there, in Richland, Don Reed. Yeah. So they were all from one group.
Yeah, They were the
real deal, put it that way. And they had held the powerhouse of British sprinting all that time until Linford came along.
Tell us about the Olympics in Seoul then. Did you?
Brilliant.
Was it wonderful?
Absolutely loved it. It was my very first Olympic Games, and the whole
culture. Had you been to Asia before?
Never. So it was the culture that really came alive for me.
Until you go to Japan or Korea for the first time, you think you're a traveller, and then if you're from an English speaking part of the world, and you go there and there's not a word of English anywhere.
No, unbelievable.
It's frightening.
It was really unbelievable. And I just loved the excitement, the vibrancy, the busyness of this whole new culture that I was experiencing. So to go to the Olympic Games was a nice byproduct, really, of experiencing a brand new culture.
How did you get on, you think? Look back on it. You won a silver medal.
Silver medal.
Again behind Roger Kingdom.
Yeah. Roger was the main man. He was already the Olympic champion, and we were all looking at what he could do, but he ran very well, 12.98. He won that title. Then I came home in 13.28 with a silver medal. And I was excited about that because I was the second fastest in the world. So I thought I should come home with a silver anyway. But I just wanted to have it. You know, you need to own that medal.
Yeah.
And again, my very first Olympic silver was a special time for me.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Kingdom used to sing before the races.
It was terrible. Roger always used to sing, always skipping along and looking at us all. And his favourite tune was "We're Off to See the Wizard, the Wonderful Wizard of Oz." And I can remember
what an extraordinary
it, like,
choice.
I know. We're off to see the. I can remember.
Except, of course, he's not like doing a pop song and trying to be cool. He knows that everyone knows this, so you know how relaxed he is because everybody knows. That's a sitting in front of the television watching a film song, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know?
That's exactly right.
We're off to see the wizard.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And, you know, I looked at him and sometimes I thought, I would like to plant this chair right over your head here. Now, let us all concentrate and focus. But no, Roger was extraordinary.
I'm going to ask you a question now before we get Malcolm Arnold, your genius coach, up in just a second. Yeah. You're 21 years of age. You've got a silver medal. It's a big silver medal. The Olympic medal is quite large.
It's big,
the palm of your hand. It's like you could eat your dinner off it. Yeah. If I'd said to you then, Colin, you'll never win another Olympic medal.
What would you have said to me? I would have said to you, get away. No way. I'm 21. Of course I'm going to win another, at least
another
two.
And
one of them will be a gold. So I have no worries about that. So I would never, ever have thought that that I'd only have a silver.
Because as well as being the most successful championship runner we've ever had from this country, and just a pile of medals indoors and out, and part of this story is that you don't go on to win an Olympic gold medal, and we'll talk about that a little later on. You're smiling about it now. I bet there have been times when that smile wasn't quite so broad. We should talk about Seoul and about you as a young runner and with a man who saw you through all 18 years. My God, he's got some patience. He probably had 20 years with you as your coach. The great Malcolm Arnold joins us on the line now. Hello, Malcolm.
Hello there, how are you?
Very, very good indeed. And more to the point, it's good to see that you're still alive and kicking after 20 years of listening to Colin Jackson going on.
Well, all I've got of his career left now is white hair.
Thank you very much. I'm joining you down that road soon, Mal. I still have some hair and it's getting whiter by the moment.
I'm telling
you're getting fatter as well, I see.
Yeah, exactly.
Both those things are very fashionable, let me tell you. Malcolm, we've been talking about Roger Kingdom and we'll go on to talk about some other great hurdlers, but let's get this into perspective. Under your tuition, how great a hurdler was Colin Jackson? How great did he become?
Well, that's simple to answer, really, isn't it? His record speaks for itself, which is very outstanding. Simple as that.
Well, we'll come on to his world records indoors and out in a little while. Why? Why was he so brilliant?
Well, obviously, to begin with, he's physically very talented. And I always used to say to him, for me, it always comes from heredity. Yeah. And I always used to say to him, every time you see your mum and dad, say thank you, because he had good parents he has good parents still in many ways. And one of the things he inherited from them was good physical qualities. And then once Colin realised he was good at what he was doing, he was very mature in his outlook, in working hard, knowing what he wanted and how to get there. And obviously I helped in that process as well. So it was when you work with good athletes, then it's an easier task than working with not so good athletes. So he was good to work with.
Do you know what's interesting about Malcolm? Malcolm says, I'm this, I'm that, I'm that, but he's an outstanding coach. To be able to translate.
How do you know? You've never had any other.
Well, no. I did actually. Yeah, but it's the way you get your message across to the athlete, and it's not just the way that you got the message across to me. I mean, this man has won 66 major medals across the board. I've only won a couple of them for him. So he's got to be able to translate his knowledge and give it on. And I think for us, where I was lucky was that I found Malcolm.
Malcolm, earlier on, Colin described himself as lazy. I have a suspicion that can't be true if you're going to be a world class at a technical event.
Well, if I say anything more good about him, I want to know where to send the invoice as well. Is that okay?
Well, not to this radio station, that's for sure. You might try his other employers, but not here.
Yeah. He's, what was your question? Sorry.
Yeah.
Is he lazy?
No. I mean, he may. To become a good athlete, or to become a good performer in any sport, nowadays you need talent. Once upon a time, say when I was young, 1,000 years ago, talent was good enough to get you anywhere. But nowadays, so many people work hard at it, and sadly, so many people take illegal shortcuts as well, that to do it properly and to do it legally and so on, you have to have talent and you have to work damned hard as well. So he may have been lazy in certain areas, as far as track and field was concerned, there was none that I observed.
Well, Malcolm, it's been an absolute joy to talk to you. And on behalf of Grateful Nation, thank you for taking Colin Jackson in hand and producing all those medals for us.
It was difficult, but we survived in the end.
Cheers, buddy.
Thank you. That's the great Malcolm Arnold. And we'll talk more about the aftermath of Seoul in just a second. We talked about the Olympics in Seoul, and in fact, you got your silver medal and you shared a room with Linford Christie. This might be a time to talk about what happened to Linford at the end of those Olympics. Obviously, it's the Ben Johnson race, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And let's be absolutely frank about it. I think, and including Linford, I want to be honest about this, 7 of the 8 finishers in that race have now in some way or other been implicated over the years with some kind of drugs irregularities.
Well, if you remember that race when Ben Johnson crossed the line first, he ran a magnificent time, 9.79, and we were all...
His body still ran that time. We've got to be honest about that, haven't we?
He still ran 9.79, and that doesn't come easy. He still had to work very hard to do that. And then when the news broke, we were all gobsmacked, because you have an idea, you know, you see somebody and you see what their performance is, you look at their body structure, you think to yourself, that is normally
developed. He had changed shape, hadn't he?
Massively.
In the same way that Dwayne Chambers, with all due respect, him, very talented guy, he changed shape. And you think, why are you changing shape in the middle of your career?
Yeah, it looked very strange to us. Yeah. And the performances kind of told us something was going on, right? So with that in mind, we weren't surprised that he got busted. But it was like, he still got busted. We could not believe this.
Olympic champion.
The big star of the Olympic Games. We all knew he was a massive head-to-head with Carl Lewis. So we were all literally gobsmacked. And then, I'm not sure if people kind of remember then Linford had that little bit of an issue with
Ginseng
due the time. And he himself was absolutely mortified when he was going through that process. Especially when he gave him the bottle while he was taking, and they tested and said, well, that is what was in your urine. And he said, well, I didn't quite understand then why you're absolutely drilling me so much in this circumstance. So it was an interesting time, 1980. I think it was a real turnaround for when we started to really fight drugs in a different way.
Do you suspect there was much? I mean, you don't hear about so many of the hurdlers fail. No. Do hurdlers fail drugs tests?
I'm trying to think of any of the great hurdlers.
But, it's bizarre because you're essentially doing much the same training, aren't you?
Yeah, sprinter. I think it's because you can't be really that big. You still got to have. You got to be like gazelle like because you've got to jump.
Roger Kingdom notwithstanding.
Yeah, well, he was really came from the world of discus throwing, so he's slightly
different.
He
made an excellent sort of cruiserweight boxer, wouldn't he, Roger? Yeah.
Absolutely. He did get his
You don't need to be taking any extra muscle off the ground.
Yeah, you don't want to be doing that. No. So you want to be as light, as felt light as you possibly can, so and nimble on your feet. So perhaps that's a reason why, or your focus is slightly different, or you can always get lots of ways to improve.
Because it's a technical event.
Yeah.
It's not just about
flying. It's not raw power. Perhaps that's what plays to our advantage as well.
We've already heard, of course, earlier on that you upgraded to a Ford Sierra. Did your life change after the Olympics in Seoul?
Yeah, I was far more recognised. I enjoyed being around everybody, and I really then felt part of like a real group, you know. It was a group of elite athletes, Olympians, and I'd won a medal. It was fantastic. And I was really looking forward to the future, but also I wanted to know what I was going to do, where I was going to go, what direction I was going to really go in, because it was 4 years before I could do anything else at an Olympic Games, and there's lots of bits and bobs in between, but it's still the Olympic Games is in your mind.
You still have things to do. You need to win major gold medals. You need to crack 13 seconds for your event, which is the equivalent, I guess. People say it's the equivalent of 10 seconds in the 100 metres. I'm not sure of that anymore.
No, it's
I think it's like 9.5 seconds, yeah. Really, isn't it?
It is tougher to go under 13 seconds.
Absolutely. Because, well, look, only so few people have done it even now. You know?
Yeah.
If you're doing it now, you're in line for a medal.
Well, there's no doubt. It's a tough old thing to go there. Because you can imagine, hurdling is formatted for you. So it's either 7 or 8 strides to the first hurdle, 3 strides in between, and then 4 strides to the finish. And that is it. So you've got to try and work on your speed and your technique to improve at time. And that's what makes it so difficult to get those big
you can work on your fantastic dip across the line, in which you are the undisputed all-time champion. Once you went underneath the laser timer, as I recall.
I would say 70% of my races I go under the photo finish. Yeah. And, you know, the clock would stop at like 13.5 and you're going, no way is that 13.5. It's so much better than that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I used to find that quite funny, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Just proves how flexible I was.
Indeed. Let's talk about the 1990 Commonwealth Games, again representing Wales.
Yeah.
In Auckland, we associate athletics, even in London, the sun shone. My recollection is that was one of the coldest looking places on earth.
It was perishing. It was about 11 or 12 degrees. I can remember. Oh, gosh. But it was, again, me really just keeping my level, my real world-class level in people's mind. I ran 13.08, which was a new championship record. It was one of the fastest, well, the second fastest time in the world. But it was also stamping your authority, really.
Tony Jarrett of England was second.
Bless. Yeah. Sorry, Tony. Every time I got a gold, Tony got the silver.
Yeah.
So it was, it was a good time because we still felt very much a team. It was a real unifying moment for us all. And we enjoyed getting on the rostrum together, high fives, and it's just like old times.
You the European Championships in Split.
Yeah, the same year.
You won in you did 13.18 to win there with Tony Jarrett second. It says in a book that I've read about that you wrote that you actually after that, although it all seems like triumph and waving at the TV cameras, you went into afterwards that race and cried.
Yeah, I was in so much pain and so much stress. I had a knee problem that I was worried about, and I didn't think I was going to get through the race, and I think I finished third or fourth in the semi-final. So I literally scraped into the final. That's why I was in one of the outside lanes. And I was in dire problems. And Malcolm literally talked me into racing because I was going to pull out. But he talked me into racing, and the doctors strapped me up. And I thought, I've got one shot at this and I better make it a good one. And I just did whatever came natural, and I hung on in there and just took the title. When I mean just took it, I won by 300 in front of Tony. So it was a very, very close race.
Okay, well, that brings us around then to the glory days are still to come. Don't worry, we're going to start breaking world records up in a minute. But I want to get into, because we've got a few minutes to get into, the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona.
Mm.
You were the fastest man in the world by then. Mm. You weren't broke the world record, but you would be the fastest man in the field.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be the day, after what we talked about in Seoul, where you're now established, you're part of the athletics fraternity, you're a well-known figure. You're supposed to win this Olympics. This is the one you're supposed to win, isn't it?
Yes.
What happened?
Yes, I was supposed to win this.
Did you think you were going to win in the run-up to it?
Yeah, I had no worries. I didn't even think, it wasn't even a question that I was going to win it.
Who were your major rivals? Mark McCoy was Mark still McCoy, around, but you're beating Mark regularly.
Well, Mark's my training partner, yeah. So I see him every single day. Yeah. He's the second best athlete in the world.
Yeah, and he's used to
events.
The sight of your heels,
so
yeah?
I was training with this guy, so it wasn't a real major threat in my mind.
Anybody else who could possibly have been?
Tony Dees was the number one American, and he was somebody that we would have to watch out for, because him and Mark had done a couple of good battles on the circuit, and Tony had beaten Mark on some occasions, and I'd beaten Tony on every occasion. So for me, it was nearly a formality. I just had to prepare well and be healthy when I arrived on the line. I was so confident that I sent home my massage therapist from our training camp. It wasn't necessary to have him there. I'm not training, I'm just racing, and I never get usually injured in a race.
Is that what's called tempting fate, Colin?
Yeah, I think so. And I ran the first round, and literally I walked across the line, and I looked at the clock and I laughed, because it was a time of 13.10 seconds. I think only Tony Dees had run faster than that all year.
And you
I
were thought jogging
it was
that, now.
And I was literally just like...
In as far as you can, the hurdles. It's very hard to do that.
I was it was literally jogging.
Okay.
It was literally jogging. And I thought to myself... Aye, this is not just a title here. I think the world record's on the cards. So in my mind, that was all. I was already on the top of the rostrum with my medal, and it was just going to be the
practicing
world record.
Practicing your tears for God Save the Queen.
You got it.
Yeah.
And so I was really anxious and looking forward to it. But the problem I had was second round. I didn't warm up for it. It was about 2 hours after the heat, and it was warm. It was Barcelona, and I didn't warm up for it. I caught one of the hurdles, and I ended up tearing my left oblique. And once that had gone,
which
it was history.
For those who are not medical people, what's an oblique?
They are called your love handles.
Okay, right.
So you know exactly where they are.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I ripped my left one, you can't hurdle very well without it, because it stabilises and it also gives you that power to elevate it. And that was me kaput, literally.
Well, the next day was the semi-finals and the final.
Mm.
You got through the semi-final. Mm. I think you won the semi-final.
No, Mark beat me in the semi. Mark beat me in the semi.
Then you get to the final again. Mm. It's the Olympic Games. You're going to have one go at it.
Mm.
Unfortunately for you, there was a false start. So whatever chance you might have had, I mean, I don't suppose you had a real chance, but whatever chance you did have, you're putting pressure on the muscle again, aren't you?
Yeah. The problem we have is when you've torn a muscle like that is just standing around, because as you're standing around, it just gets tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. So I had to do as much movement as I possibly can. But you know what movement is. Movement is taking away energy, et cetera, et cetera. So I was in a real catch-22 situation. All I wanted was a clean start, because it just saved me hanging around for another 2 or 3 minutes, which I didn't want to do. And unfortunately, it didn't happen.
Ironically, the person who didn't clean start now lost to history a little bit is a British athlete called Hugh Teep.
Huey. And do you know what? I couldn't say.
Did he know the state you were in?
No. Only Mark would have known that I was in a bad way. You know, Hugh said to me that he wasn't expecting to be in the final. And the only way he was going to get his name mentioned on the television if he had a false start. So why not? And I thought to myself, do you know what? Why not? Absolutely, why not? Hey, most people just call him Big Brother nowadays, right? To get themselves there. Huge at the false start.
And the thing is, I mean, I'm sure you were devastated. Mark McCoy won. I don't know whether you were happy or sad about that. But
it was a bit of mixed emotions.
Yeah. What's Morrissey's song? We hate it when our friends become successful.
But yeah, I tell you why it was mixed for me. Initially, it's because I knew our training was absolutely spot on. And that was crucial, because we had another year to go for a world championship. So Mark winning told me that it was just me that did it wrong. I didn't concentrate. I didn't focus.
10 days later, in Monaco, you beat all the people in the Olympic final in a time that was faster than the Olympic final was won in.
All right, don't rub it in. Yes, you're absolutely right. It was the Olympic final, and we lined up again to do the run, and I literally, then I thought, I just need to win this race. So I just ran very...
Was Hugh Teep in
very,
it?
No.
No, he wasn't allowed in there.
No, Hugh was replaced actually by Roger Kingdom.
Okay, so it's a good replacement. Up in the ante, yeah.
But yeah, it was interesting because I just ran very safely. I protected myself just to make sure, because I just needed the victory to prove something to myself. And when I saw the winning time, I think that's really what upset me then, because I thought, why didn't that happen 10 days earlier?
Colin, you know what it is? You watched it in the stadium yourself less than a year ago. Greg Rutherford, his jump was nothing special historically, but he did it on the right place, on the right day, and he's wandering around now, sorry, Colin, but with a gold medal around his head. Next, after that disappointing despair at the 1992 Olympics, the following year brings very contrasting fortunes. You prove yourself, without doubt, the best on the planet by winning gold at the World Championship in Stuttgart and a world record that stood for years and years and years. So we're going to start being a little bit more positive now here on My Sporting Life. First up to the hockey tonight is Mike at Mokorewo, who says, you half answered this, but can you tell me what the split is, Colin? He says, between the percentage between genetics and training in sport.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well,
it's a huge issue, I know.
Yeah, I ended up... I first of all thought it was like 75% training and 25% what you're given. And then when I kind of went through the whole development and seen who I was and how I developed the person I was going to be, I put it down to 50-50.
Yeah.
Absolutely 50-50.
The example I always give now is the number of professional footballers who are themselves the sons of either professional athletes or professional football. It's amazing.
Yeah, you know? Nature and nurture. I mean, I think it's a real split, 50-50.
Absolutely. Claire at Lurverick, she says, I'd love to know who Colin's ultimate athletics great is.
Oh, goodness me, there's so
Thompson
many.
Thompson or someone beyond Thompson?
See, I think, for me, Daly was just the most incredible athlete, because if he was around nowadays as well, you'd see how big Usain Bolt is. I think Daly would have been certainly marching shoulders by shoulder with him, because he had that style, he had the charisma, but most of all, he was a champion.
Okay, well, the next two both have got very, very high expectations of you. Kev O'Sullivan at Kev O'Sullivan 07 says, would Colin have been so good without Roger Kingdom and Tony Jarrett to push him?
You're right, I wouldn't have been. And the real reason for that is that you need somebody to focus on. So that was that person, was Roger, obviously. I wanted to take his title from him, but also to have someone on your doorstep who's chasing you all the time. And I never wanted to get caught by Tony. So I had really a good opportunity to develop. And I always thank those two guys.
And Tony Mitchell, who's at Maverick Mitch. Listen, I don't know. I'm going to hold this one at arm's length before I read it. So. Colin, I'll read it in the tone. Although you had a glittering career, do you feel that maybe you could have achieved more, says Tony here?
Yeah, he's right. There's one more. Of course, I could have won an Olympic gold medal. I should have won an Olympic gold medal. So, yeah, I mean, that's the only thing that's missing.
It's not your only big failure in my life. Oh. I work here every day with Darren Goff.
Oh,
For you to let Goff beat you at Strictly Come Dancing. We'll come on to that later, but really, that is a better... surely that's punishable in some sort of way. Listen, we've already reached the halfway stage of what I think is a very, very entertaining edition of My Sporting Life. And coming up next, we'll be discussing your athletics career post-Barcelona, including your two gold medals at the World Championships, the world record you set in winning the first of those, as well as numerous other titles, including a further three European gold medals, and the life after you retired from the track, your time in coaching, Strictly Come Dancing, which I've already alluded to, your media career and much else besides. You'll listen to Colin Jackson here on My Sporting Life with me, Danny Kelly. After your disappointment in Barcelona, what were your own... you must have felt under tremendous pressure then.
Huge pressure. Self-pressure.
Yeah.
Pressure I put on myself. I knew I'd let down a lot of people at the Olympic Games.
Do you really think you had? I mean, you're hurt, you're hurt.
No, I let down a lot of people in my mind. People have put time and effort, and I had this dream, and people wanted me to succeed in my dream, and they worked hard and put themselves out to make me fulfil that dream. And I kind of
felt your parents had sort of supported you for a short while. I mean, and Malcolm, and you know.
Yeah, but you know what? They're also your support mechanism, and they're the ones who are there for you when things are not going particularly very well either. And they're the ones who are dealing with your moods that are consistently changing because you've had a great session or a bad session, or you've lost a race, or you've just been stopped speeding in your new car, whatever, you know. Yeah. they're the people that's got to deal with those type of things. So, you know, I did felt a huge sense of responsibility, and I knew I couldn't fail that year.
So tell us about the build-up to the World Championships, which were in Stuttgart in Germany.
Well, I was competing very well, and again, I wasn't losing competitions, and I knew I was the world number one going into that championships. My major focus was believe in myself. I really had to really believe in myself and do not get too cocky. Do not go be arrogant in any shape or form and deliver what you're capable of delivering.
But surely Barcelona must have put you into your head that, you know, you've got to put the negatives out of your head, but if ever there was something that would make you guard against complacency, it would be what had happened to you in the Olympics.
Yeah, but also that can kind of twist you in another way, because it can make you think to yourself, well, perhaps I can't absolutely deliver on the highest level. So you it can take you down another pathway as well, especially for me, having my training partner raise his game and take the title in such an explosive way. So for me, the most important thing was to always keep self-belief and really deliver what I knew I was capable of delivering, and that was just victories on the highest level.
I could say that in the run-up as well to Stuttgart, you were second in the World Indoor Championships, but they were in Canada. Mark McCoy won it, I think, right, saying, but with a false start where he was halfway down the track and they just ignored it. So, but I actually want to talk about something else that's going on in the build-up to this. By this stage in your career, you're doing lots of things very, very right to get yourself ready. But I understand you were, I don't know whether to talk about problems with your eating, with your eating regime. You would go days without eating.
Yeah, I was obsessed.
But eventually that becomes anorexia, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think you had anorexia?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I would have looked at myself and thought to myself that I was slightly bigger than it was necessary to be. And I remember at the stage, one of my training partners...
What about sports science? Surely you must have an ideal running weight.
Well, I didn't know what that absolutely was. All I knew was the lighter I was, the stronger I was, the quicker I was. That was the only thing that was in my mind. So the key thing was to lose as much weight as I possibly can and try and perform the best I can off being as light as I can. So I used to lie about my weight and say I used to say I was a little bit heavier than I actually was.
You're laughing
about it.
You're laughing about it. Did you deliberately starve yourself? What were you doing to achieve this weight loss? Because when you're an athlete, you're burning up a lot of calories anyway.
Yeah, but I didn't do many other things outside of sport or athletics because I didn't have the energy. I'll be blatantly obvious with that. I didn't have the energy. So every single training session I did, I literally had to physically raise myself to go out there and do what I was supposed to do. I was exhausted after training. I mean, literally exhausted after training. And yes, I would starve myself. Yeah,
I understand you're actually making a program for another station about this very issue now.
Yeah, and what the whole problem that they're kind of leading to was the fact that lots of people only think it happens with women distance runners or middle distance runners, and it doesn't happen with power athletes and certainly not men. So that's the reason why I said to them, I'm more than happy to be involved and explain that. And it was a funny question they asked me was, when do you get over it? When do you absolutely get over that? The men, and I said, you never do. You always get that. It's always in the back of your mind. It's how you set yourself up. You know what it's like. You set yourself up. You're in that position and you take that path.
Well, hopefully it doesn't cause you any more problems, Colin. And if it is causing you problems, I have here a list of London's best pie shops that I can most certainly recommend to you. Whatever way you're preparing, let's talk about Stuttgart. Let's cut straight to the chase here. You win the gold medal, and in that wonderful way that sometimes these things come together in a person's life, you win the gold medal and break the world record in the same race, and you go, I mean, break it. 12:91. I mean, you need a parachute to stop your going so quick, yeah?
I was a little bit disappointed in breaking the world record then as well, because I'm greedy. You gathered in that, right? Yeah. I'm pretty greedy. And I said I wanted to win the title and have that feeling of winning my very first global title. But then I wanted to go on to a couple of, you know, races after and then break the world record to get two separate feelings. Successful.
Sergei Bubka used to like the feeling of the $50,000 you got for breaking the world record against. He used to break it by the pole vaulter, one centimetre at a time, because he liked the feeling of the $50,000 in his hand.
Oh, you never got that feeling very often, no. Unfortunately. But yeah, no, that was the reason. I was ecstatic, I must admit. To win
interestingly,
the title was great.
I think you controlled the whole event very well, because in semi-final you didn't even win. I think I'm right in saying that you ran by your own standards quite slowly. Tony Jarrett, bless him, ran 3:14, but you...
Yeah, I think I was third going in, ranked third with my time.
What was that about then?
It was just running safe. It was just about, you know, realising I'm in great shape here now. And the most important thing is just to qualify, because if you're not in the final, you can't win the titles. As simple as that. So play it safe, CJ, play it safe. And once you get in the final, give it all you got.
Tell us about the final.
Well, I remember the whole stage stadium going completely silent when we went to our blocks. And I'd settled into the blocks and I was really ready to go. My preparation was a bit iffy because I'd made a couple of mistakes in the build-up and doing some practice starts. And I decided just to forget all that and just leave it. Get in your blocks and do what you can do.
Tony Jarrett was in the race one side of you. I think Jack Pierce, the American...
Jack was there, Tony Dees was there. And, you know, it was going to be a tough competition. And I remember when the gun absolutely went and exploded, I burst out of the blocks. I took my first two strides and I knew I'd won the race. It was one of these weird feelings. It's like I was just taken and saying, okay, this is yours. And then I had to wake myself up, literally wake myself up and thinking, you need to clear some hurdles here, Sunshine. And I started clearing these hurdles. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Got to hurdle 6 and absolutely ran out of steam. I was exhausted. And I remember thinking that was literally bad nutrition that had taken my power away from me. And I literally thought to myself, oh God, this is it. This is not happening, because I could literally not feel my legs. And I was just clawing my way through the next four hurdles. And I ended up clattering the 10th barrier and staggered into the line. And so I was surprised that I actually managed to break the world record in that circumstance.
So when you saw that world record at the end of it, what were your feelings then? Can you remember your feelings?
I glanced at the clock and I saw the time, 12.91 seconds. And I thought, oh, well, if that's, yeah, well, that could be the world record. I'm not so sure. Let me just enjoy this moment. I went around to the lap of honour and I was waving to the crowd and I was smiling. And you can imagine the sensation I was feeling, because it was every single emotion that went through me. Relief because I'd won my first title. Excitement because I'm world champion. And there was this buzz around the stadium and I couldn't quite understand what was going on.
It's become more the norm now at athletics. It didn't used to be that family members are there for these really big events. Were your family, your family there?
No, they were back home in Wales. They were watching there. But it's when I came down the back straight and I looked on the big notice board and I was listening to the infield commentator, and he said, Colin Jackson, the new world champion and new world record holder. And I had this massive cheesy grin on myself because I could not believe it. And all I kind of kept thinking about was my real humble beginning, just thinking, oh, God.
Why does everyone do that? Everybody does that.
It's incredible. Because it's really disbelief. You know, I thought to myself, my parents came over here to this country as immigrants. They settled themselves in. They had myself and my sister. Look what their hard work has achieved. You know,
someone on casualty.
Somebody on casualty. But it was just incredible. It was just an incredible feeling and really disbelief. And I just thought, I just want to get home.
Your record stood for 9 years. Which shows, A, it was a very, very good record. Yeah. And B, what did you feel when it finally went? I mean, the big...
Lu Zhang from China.
A giant.
He equaled it in at the Olympic Games in 2004. So hang on, what did I set it in 93?
So 9 years.
So 11 years.
11 years.
He equaled it then, and then he broke it fully in 2006. So yeah, it was around for 13 years in total. It's funny, I felt no attachment to it. Once I'd retired from the sport of athletics, I felt no attachment to that world record, because it was like, that was then.
Yeah.
And when I retired as the best I could possibly be, and the best I could possibly be was the best the world had seen at that particular moment in time. So I had no real attachment to it. So it was like, okay, great, nice.
There must be a part of you who watches, say, an Olympic final, and you just think, oh, four of those still not running that time, I know this year. Maybe five of them. Yeah?
No, I don't reflect like that, funny. Okay. I just don't do that. I wish I did, actually. I think I did. I think there's something wrong with me when I don't do.
Well, listen, I must talk about the indoor season in 1994, where at a place called, you can help me with this, Sindelfingen. Where the hell is Sindelfingen?
It's just outside Stuttgart, funny. Right. It's 7 miles outside Stuttgart.
Okay, well, you break the world record in the 60 metres hurdles indoors in winning that. Was it world or your world indoor? Yeah. World? No, European Championships. Sorry, that's just, get this right, Danny. You break the world record at Sindelfingen, then you go on to Paris
to
win gold medal in the hurdles. And the sprinting, if you don't mind, and the 60 metres flat. Yes, first of all, talking about the world record in Sindelfingen.
Okay, Sindelfingen was a great track. I always ran very well there. I set the European record there in 1989. Mm-hmm. So it was me returning, really, to old stomping ground to see what I could do. So I knew I was in great shape again. And it was an important thing was to run as fast as I possibly could. because now I was genuinely attacking the world record. I'd already equaled it a couple of times beforehand, so I really wanted to take ownership of the indoor world record. And
even though you didn't like the event,
I couldn't stand it. But eventually, I nailed the start and I got the first two hurdles right, and it took me a time of 7.30 seconds, which, oh gosh, it stood since 1994. And I remember then when I crossed the line, I saw the clock. I remember thinking to myself, oh, I'm gutted. And like Mark was in the race, and that's my training partner, and he was like, why are you like that? And I said, well, I've now realised, Mark, I will never, ever, ever run that fast again. And that's not a nice feeling when you're 22nd.
Although,
27 at the time, yeah.
Although you might add that no human being has run that fast again, ever.
Yeah, but I wasn't thinking about it. I'm selfish, remember?
Yeah. No, I mean, given that hurdling is a very major sport indoors, yeah. It's not like something, but yeah, everyone takes part in it because it's 60 metres, yeah. And it can be done quickly.
Yeah.
The record still stands, doesn't it?
Yeah, since 1994. I mean, I'm surprised that it really stayed so long, because we've had some great hurdlers, you know, from Liu Zhang to Aris Merritt to Daniel Robles, yeah. Of Cuba. These guys were quick, but I just managed to hang on with that one world record. So.
And a few weeks later, you go to Paris for the European Indoor Championships. You win the hurdles again. No big deal now, I'm saying. You're 1/100th of a second outside. No, sorry, 1/1100th of a second outside your own world record. Yeah. But no, let me get this right. You ran 6:49
in the 60 flat
to win the flat.
Yeah.
First of all, why did you enter the flat? That's just a bit hilarious, isn't it?
Well, I kind of was sprinting quite well anyway, so I thought to myself, shall I have a go at the double? So I have a word with the coach first of all, and he said, yeah, you should do it. And then I spoke to Linford, and I said to Linford, shall I have a go at the double? And he went, well, you might as well have a go, you know. You're not going to really lose anything. You're just going to gain something.
I take it Linford wasn't running in this, otherwise, yeah.
No, he was at home, and yeah, he wasn't expecting me to run 6:49.
Really?
That was for sure. He knew I was going to run quickly, but he didn't think I'd go into 7.5, because virtually anybody goes under 6.5 seconds tends to go sub 10 seconds for the 100 metres.
Okay.
So that was kind of the ballpark figure, and my 100 metres personal best was 10:29 at that time, so nobody was expecting me to go so quickly, but I managed to go 6:49 and take the title.
Did you enjoy that?
I loved it, absolutely loved it, you know, rubbing salt into the wound of all the sprinters of Europe, the best sprinters in Europe, was wonderful.
I mean, the indoor sprinting for me, and forgive me, this is not very athletic, the bit I love about it, you run through the line at 100 miles an hour, whatever you're doing, then up the banking, and you have to run to those mattresses at the far end, like
how
you have to crash land in the mattresses.
How many times? The runoff is about nearly 30 metres, and you're trying to slow down so quickly. You literally go right over. Sometimes you can go over the top of these mats. But yeah, you do.
Because, I mean, you have to bear in mind that since then, 100 metres, you're decelerating for the second half of the race. You're actually in the 60 metres. You're running as fast as anybody could be when you go through the line. Yeah.
So it is a tricky thing to handle, the slowing up process. But then, yeah, so that was a lovely surprise title about, you know, the 60 hurdles that people expect me to win at.
Yeah, well, and what we have, I mean, you go on. At this time, you're just incredibly successful, and unless you get injured, it seems to me you're unbeatable for about 2 years.
Yeah.
If you're Gebrehalle Selassie, if you're in a distance where you have time to work out every race, it seems to me that in a technical event, it's much more difficult to be unbeaten at that time. Because, let's be fair, you could go arse over tip, couldn't you?
Yeah, quite quickly. Yeah. Absolutely. And the amount of races you're running as well, because, you know,
you can... As a sprinter, you've got a lot of times. Your run was 44, races. Wasn't it?
Yeah. The run of 44... was pretty impressive. Even if I say so myself, I look back and I thought, oh God, that wasn't too bad at all. But if you went back another year and took into, say, 1992, and you went from 1992 to the 1995, I'd most probably just lost one race out of 70. So the actual run itself was pretty outstanding. Even if I say so myself, I look at it thinking, I'm surprised. everything kind of shocks me still, because I don't recognise that person, if that makes sense.
Sure, you're into another part of your life
now,
aren't you?
Yeah, it's like, God, what happened there? Who was this dude?
Did you ever fall over, Colin?
Oh, God, yeah, many occasions.
Well, clearly not for 3 years, you didn't know.
Yeah, but that was the real business, in training and in the practice. When you make mistakes, you take the risks, you want to improve.
It does look terrible when a high hurdler, I mean, it looks terrible because it looks bloody painful for a start, doesn't it?
Yeah, you hit the floor quickly.
you tumble a long way and all the rest of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my training partners, Paul Gray, broke his wrist and his shoulder just when he hit the first hurdle, because he hit it so badly. So, you know, accidents do happen.
Oh, I know someone I meant to ask you about when you go back to your double, when you run the sprint as well.
Yeah.
In many ways, I always thought that Gail Devers was one of the most extraordinary athletes the world's ever seen. She was good enough to be
Olympic champion
at both events. Yeah. Extraordinary.
Yeah. No,
do you know Gail?
I know Gail very well. And I always used to wind it up something chronic, because if you ask Gail the question, what are you? You a sprinter or you a hurdler? She would always define herself as a hurdler. And I'd say, you need to look at the videos. Trust me, you're a sprinter, Gail. You are not a hurdler at all. But yeah, titles say it all. And she was a great hurdler in that sense.
I mean, Colin, I don't mean to after 95, I mean, we're still, with all athletes, it becomes a time when, even though you're only in your late 20s, I hear the story again and again and again. There are triumphs to come, still loads of medals for you.
Yeah.
But it becomes a battle against the human body, because not just the elasticity starts to go, and that may not happen to your 32 or 33, but just every injury brings another problem, doesn't it? And you get into all that, don't you?
Yeah, there is problems. And that's also linked with your mental state as well, also. Because you can imagine you've had a huge acceleration pathway, and you've put a lot of time and effort, hours and hours and hours and hours of training in. So there's a time when the body goes, can't take any more. And that's when you really have to put that huge battle in, both mentally and physically.
I mean, we talked about your... I won't use the word failure. That's not right, because your inability to get your hands on an Olympic gold medal. Mm. Last chance comes, I guess, for you in 1996 in Atlanta. You're still a very competitive runner, though not perhaps in the form. And also, I think you must have been aware of it as well. We talked a lot about the people you raced against, you know, the McCoys of this world and the Kingdoms of this world and Tony Jarrett. And then you look at that Olympic final with Mark Creer, Florian Schwarzkopf. There was a kind of changing of the guard, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, but they were all people I could beat. Why was I fourth? Bad attitude. You know, when we talk about a mental attitude again being bad, a very bad attitude. If you looked at my whole run-up into that Olympic Games, my times were much quicker in training, in preparation there, than they were before 1992. But I really wasn't in or up for the game. I wasn't enjoying my athletics at that period in my life, and it seemed like it was hampering me more than inspiring me. So I had to have a real rethink after those Olympic Games in Atlanta, because what was I going to do? Was I going to retire? I already was world record holder, won world titles, or should I go on? And sure.
I guess you did give yourself a stern talking to, because there is a lovely gold moment, isn't there, at 32 years of age in Seville, where you win another gold medal in the world championships, which is just fantastic. 6 years after winning your first one, which for a sprinter takes some doing. Mm. Although I can't say that. I think the quality of the field might have been down. Is Diana Ross in third place here? I mean, that is not a quality field, is it? Oh, Dwayne Ross, sorry. It looks like Diana Ross on my screen. I thought, that is not a good final.
You know, I said to have the problem...
Whitney Houston was second. This is no good at all.
You know, I tend to do this, right? But I ended up training. I was training with Dwayne. Dwayne came to join my training group.
And he's
was
American,
training with us. Yeah. And Dwayne was training with us and from the January, literally.
So you
right
keep training
through.
People to finish just behind you,
What was I thinking, right? But no, it was a fun time to do that, and I think for me it was nice to show these young boys that us old boys can still do it.
Well, listen, there were still even more medals to come. You added a final fourth successive European Championship gold in 2002 in Munich, meaning your unbroken run as European champion stretched back to 1990, which is just fantastic. You also won a silver medal in Manchester, in case anyone forgets, in the 2002 Commonwealth Games. Daft question, but why did you decide to retire? I mean, earlier on when we were talking off air, you said that you'd come to a point in your life, you and a whole generation of British sprinters, where you just thought, how much more can we keep doing this? Yeah. Not that you didn't care, but you didn't care enough.
No, it's
true. Is that fair?
You could train as much as you wanted to do, and we enjoyed the social aspects of the training. It was the competition that was really getting on your nerves. It was like, oh, I've got to go again, and I've got to go again.
It's about that peaking thing, isn't it?
So you've got to be able to raise your game. You've got to lift your performance, because it's always great to be able to train well, but you must be able to lift your performance. And that's when I found, you know what? It doesn't mean enough to me to raise my performance level a little bit more, to be inspired, to be motivated. So it's best to get out on the still at the top.
Because funny enough, when we had that question from the listener earlier on the Twitter service about DNA versus training, there's also the last 5% is all mental.
It's always in your brain.
It is. Of course it is, yeah.
Absolutely, you've got to have it there.
Yeah, for big time.
Yeah.
Well, did you know what you were going to do when you retired, Colin? Had you any idea? It's not back to electricianing for you, is it?
No, that wasn't going to happen. No. Cold winter mornings, no, I wasn't going to do that. On the side, no, that wasn't going to do that. No, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. All I did know was that I wanted to share my experience and the knowledge that I gained from someone invested in me. So obviously that was my coach, Malcolm. He'd put a lot of time and effort into it. So I thought to myself, I need to be able to do that. If I can do that and make that magic happen and get someone else to perform well, I'll certainly have a go.
So how much coaching have you actually done?
Now?
Do you do any now?
No.
But then when you retired, how much did you do? Did you get into it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well because it still gave me opportunity to keep a little bit fit. So I could hang out and work out with some of the guys I used to coach. Enjoy seeing them being successful. It was like wonderful to say, God, nice one.
Well, look, one of the people you coached, and if you'd given me 50 guesses who his coach was, I would not have guessed you, is Mark Foster, the swimmer and world silver medalist in 2008. And you coached him. I would expect you would have been coaching other sprinters, I'll be honest with you. So once again, you've defied expectations, Colin. I'm delighted to say that Mark Foster, thanks to the magic of radio, joins us on the line now. Hello, Mark.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hello there. How are you? Good?
I'm doing very, very well, thank you.
Well, Colin would probably make up some phony baloney story. So you tell me how you, a swimmer, came to have a runner as your coach.
I don't know. It was one of these things. I actually do a lot of motivational speaking, and I do talk about looking outside of the box, as it were, and the fact that Colin, who if he doesn't mind me saying, he can't swim very well himself, so how did he actually look after me? But what he was very, very good at doing, I mean, we were good friends from the bath days anyway, but what he was very good at doing was going, okay, your event lasts 21 seconds, that's a little bit like a 200-metre run on the track, and this is what a 200-metre run would do on the track. We'll translate that into the water. And I had the utmost respect for him, obviously, so I listened to every word he told me to do. And technically, I'd do that part myself because, like I say, he couldn't swim, but the relationship, it just worked.
So, Colin, how does this work? Do you stand at the side of the pool in a tracksuit with a clipboard shouting, or do you have to get in, I presume, with some kind of water wings, the way he's talking? I mean, how do you coach swimming, for God's sake?
Do you know, one time he nearly had to dive into a pool to rescue me. When we were in Miami, you saw I was in a little bit of trouble, so I didn't go in the water again.
Can you not swim, Colin? Seriously?
No, I can swim little bit. But
not like Mark Foster, no.
No, but not many people can.
What did the other swimmers say to you when you first started pitching up with Colin as your coach?
I think a lot of them were, well, actually in Britain, they were none the wiser, but I think, internationally, they were kind of a little bit psyched out because they obviously knew how good an athlete he was, and they obviously didn't know what he could do or whether it was any related to swimming. But I think like I said earlier, what he did was he took what I'd have done as an athlete and put it into the water. And I think there were a few raised eyebrows, let's say, and I think within the association, people were wondering what the hell was going on. But I literally, after 2002 Commonwealth Games, I was coaching myself, and I had an average Commonwealth Games, and we were talking a lot. And Colin said, "Well, do you want me to look after you?" This is the summer of 2002, and then literally that next summer for the World Championships in Barcelona, I went and got a silver medal, and it sort of took my performance onto another level. So he did help immensely.
Mark, no. I mean, obviously, I hear the brave words, but obviously, a huge amount of regret on your part. Yes.
Can I just say, if you get the opportunity, or any of your listeners get the opportunity, go onto YouTube and put Colin Jackson's Superstars. And when we did Superstars, I was meant to peak and swim. We got to the dive part, and Colin went, just look at the green block. I want to get off the block really well. So he went into the water like the man from Atlantis and started kicking, and he never came up. I was like, what are you doing? It's very funny.
There's no need to swim, just dive. And you know what, Foz, you're the world's best dive coach, right? Because I dived well.
It was a little bit like, Colin was a little bit like, it's like with golf. drive for show, cut for dough. He just wanted to drive for show. He just wanted that.
Mark, thank you very much indeed for explaining the fun, if unusual relationship between a running coach and a top-class swimmer, of course. Thanks very much to Mark Foster. You've gone on then to do TV. We'll come on to the serious part of that in just a second. As I said, I work here every evening with Darren Goff.
Yeah.
He beat you on the 2005 series of Strictly Come Dancing. I mean, look at him. He's ungainly. He's untelevisual. He's unattractive to look. How did you let that happen?
I had something called Dollgate, I think is the word they used. I ended up, our show dance was done with some mannequins.
Right.
And I don't think the general
I'm not
dance with mannequins.
No. Did you enjoy Strictly?
I enjoyed the whole journey. It was absolutely fantastic.
Of course, you have to use that word journey if you're on television.
That's important. And what was I found wonderful about it is I ended up learning a brand new skill, which I never thought I was going to be able to do. So to learn to ballroom dance, to do Latin was so much fun. It was literally a hoot the whole way from the beginning to the finish, a hoot.
I mean, because a lot of the competitors, obviously everyone tends to take it very seriously. Johnson's like Sergeant, perhaps not so much so. I'm amazed at how emotional people get about it. I know, for the athletes, I think they've got an advantage. They're used to learning a skill, targeting a final and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But you see the actors and actresses, and they're literally in tears when they can't do the dance steps.
Yeah, it's a real emotional thing because you want to do it well, and you want to do it well for your training partner. It's the same old, because you've invested a lot in it, and they've invested a lot in you. And they give you this sense of belief, and they're human beings. So when they do these little fancy moves, you're thinking, well, why can't I do fancy moves?
I should make the point, having taken the mickey out of you, that a year later you did come back and you're the only non-winner of a series to come back and win the Christmas special. So
yes,
competitive to the end, Colin. The other TV show series that I saw you on, and I really was interested in this, I love the series Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people find out that they're, you know, related to bank robbers or whatever it is, or sheep rustlers back in the day. And yours was different because it kind of took in the whole world. Your racial background became the issue as you were. And, you know, just tell, why did you decide to do that? Because that program can open cans of worms.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think you've hit that.
Did you consult your parents before you did it?
I consulted everybody. But yeah, all the family got consulted. Basically, because it's not just about me, it affects everybody in the family. So it was important that I gave them the respect to say, well, would you like to know the information?
What did the world's wisest woman say? Did she say you should do it?
My sister was the person who came up with the right word, saying, ultimately, you know what? We can't control the past. That wasn't us. But what we can do is control the future. So make sure whatever we do in the future is a good cause. And I thought, you're absolutely right. Sign that paperwork. Let's start researching.
And what did you discover about yourself?
Well, I had these very strange kind of splits, that's for sure. I was 55%, they call it Sub-Saharan
Black African.
So that's what they called it. 55%. Then I had 7% what they called Native American.
Which I presume is the Carib Indians.
So Caribs, Arawak, Taino, Indians. So I was 7% that, and the rest is European. So there's a lot of me that's European. So my coach kind of says that's where I get my speed, the European side. I tell him, hell no. But he would try and claim that, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would. And did you love doing that program?
Oh, it was what an amazing time. I mean, to go across to Scotland, to Jamaica, to find out what your forefathers did was just sensational. It took my breath away on every single part of
it. Has it changed you at all, knowing where you are, where you came from now?
Well, when I look in the mirror, I can understand where my bone structure comes from and my looks come from. Yeah. That makes it absolutely clear. So, yeah, it's a nice thing to do.
Let's come back to the moment, if you like. Mm. You're part of I say this with no bitterness, you're part of a movement in the media, which particularly in sports coverage says that you don't need great broadcasts. What you need is former sportsmen to do it. And you've become one of the faces of athletics in this country on the national broadcast. It's BBC to you and me, the national broadcaster.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, you've been doing it for about 6 weeks. I bet you've been doing it for 5 years or 10 years or something.
10 years.
Is it 10 years?
Yeah. 10 years. And it was bizarre because it was something I didn't particularly want to do or be involved with. And I thought, well, once I finish in the world of sport, I want to hang up my spikes and do something completely different.
Had you any idea what that was?
No, not really.
No, right, okay.
And then one of the execs from the BBC came up to me and said, you know, give us 2 years of your life. just 2 years of your life, you know, we'll train you up if you want to do that. And just
why do you think they chose you over any number of other very successful athletes?
Regardé.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, beauty, yeah. Obviously, the beauty of the visog, yeah.
The visage.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But no.
Sorry, all other athletes.
But no, I don't know. I don't know why Webby came up to me and said that he wants me to be involved. But he just asked me the question, and I said no. And then he said to me, well, come on, give us 2 years. And I said, well, all right, I'll happily give you 2 years. If you don't like it, then that's fine. You've given it a real try, but just give us 2 years. And I thought, okay, I did it. And he gave us with some, you know, when you work with some good producers, et cetera, they can really inspire you to do stuff. And they always gave me the sense of belief. And I thought, I'm actually enjoying this. And I literally stuck with it. And you still got me on your box today.
And you're still enjoying it?
I still am enjoying it, yeah. And I love those little magical moments that you want to be part of or even put your voice to. You can imagine some of the great stuff people like David Coleman have done now, mm-hmm. even Steve Cramer has done now, and their voice has gone on that tape forever and ever, amen.
Steve's very good at it, isn't he?
Yeah.
Truly,
yeah.
Really good at it.
He's grown into that
different,
role
different job,
well,
of course, what you're doing. Yeah,
absolutely,
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, but really strong, really powerful.
I guess that reached its climax for you. If you were lucky, because if you hadn't given the 2 years, you wouldn't have been around for the Olympics recently.
Exactly.
Which was, I mean, I'm sorry, people listening outside of London, and particularly those of you who paid for it outside of London, yeah. It really was astonishing and transformative for the city. But as well as being transformative for the city, the TV coverage was, and you've had the awards, yeah. Colin. Your back is blistered from being patted. It was fantastic.
It was very enjoyable for all of us. I mean, but, you know, ultimately, it's down to the athletes, because if they didn't perform...
The British athletes.
Globally, we can always talk. We still need our global superstars. You know, Usain Bolt doing what he was doing, David Rudisha breaking world records.
Amazing.
You know, Phelps doing what he was doing in Nepal, Lochte doing what he was doing in Nepal. We needed all these global superstars, but it was paramount that the Team GB did very well, and they delivered when we wanted them to deliver. And once you have that, then you're absolutely laughing and joking. It's all there, stable, we're happy, and we were going to work with a smile on our face, which of course then the general public see.
And I guess carrying on into the future with the BBC?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love working with them. It's about the team of people that you're working with. And I've got a great group of people that I'm really associated with, and I enjoy it. You know, Jonathan Edwards, Michael Johnson, Denise Lewis. Yeah, it's great.
I must say, from personally, and we're going full circle with the Welsh thing here, one of the beautiful things you did in the coverage of the Olympics was digging up, sorry, that's not the right word, is it? finding people who'd made a contribution and indeed won Olympic gold medals, who we hadn't seen on our TV screens for years and years and years. Yeah. Mary Peters was a good example. But then when Lynn Davis, who won his long jump record in 1964, appeared and looked like he could probably make the final today. I mean,
don't tell Lynn.
Having a full head of hair helps, I know.
He'd have a go.
But extraordinary to see him in such great fettle.
Fantastic. He's in great shape. But he enjoys his athletics. He still works out. He's interested in the sport. And many times when I go back to home in Wales, I will pass Lynn, you know, doing hill sprints up in the field. He's enthusiastic about it, and I think that's wonderful to see.
Do you think the word that gets bandied around the whole time is legacy? I mean, it's a ridiculous word, because it means nothing really until... Do you think there will be an effect on British society of that Olympics in London?
Well, lots of the things I think we'll have a definite legacy for. I mean, I think the world's attitude towards Great Britain is completely changed. I think now they look at us in a far more pleasant way. So, yes, I think we've had a
if that's
legacy
true,
there.
And I don't know how you measure that, but if that's true, then the amount of money we paid for it is cheap. If that was true, then it'd be a cheap investment.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I do believe that will be the case. The environment changed completely over the east side of London, which will change the temperament of the
people.
It's
very hard
there.
To explain to people who weren't in London. I mean, I lived right on the edge of the Olympic Park for many, many years in a place called Maryland, and that part where the park is now. And if you haven't been to it, and you listen to my voice, and you just come down to London for a day, get one of the fast trains from King's Cross to Stratford, because it is a very beautiful thing.
Absolutely.
In and of itself. But also, it was a swamp, a marsh. It looked like the sort of place. I said to you the other day, when we were talking about this, sort of place, if you wanted to leave a murdered body, that's where you'd go, because there's no one ever went there. And so it really has transformed that side of the city.
And it will transform people's attitudes as well, which is great. And never mind, when you see great sporting success, of course that in itself inspires young people to be sportsmen and women alike.
Well, that's the long-term project, and I'm touching wood, hoping that it's true. Okay, Colin, well, you've had nearly 2 hours talking about yourself. Now I think we must try and get to the truth about you and your character. Jamie Balch, of course, is a world gold and silver medalist sprinter himself, and a very, very good friend of yours and over the years. And he joins on the line now. Hello, Jamie.
Hello, how are you? You okay?
Very, very good indeed.
I'm nervous, Jamie. Yeah,
Colin Jackson, he's very much enjoyed 90 minutes of telling me how great he is, and then your name got mentioned and suddenly there was a narrowing in his eyes.
I totally understand why Colin's a thing now. I know a lot on Colin. And
good man. That's why you're here. That's why you're here, Jamie. I mean, go on.
Yeah, like I say, you know, last year we were on Question of Sport Live in front of 4,000 people and he totally embarrassed me. And I was so gutted that he got me. I've been thinking of all day how I can stitch him up. But I'm not as evil as Colin.
Nobody is. Jamie, you're a few years younger than Colin. And of course, you came to be friend in training, a partner and all the rest of it. Was he someone you originally aspired to and looked up to?
Yeah, well, it was amazing to, get looked after Colin, you know, when I was I've known Colin since I was about 12 years old, and, you know, seeing him, I think he's about 20 years older than me. So
22.
Yeah, to see Colin, you know, honestly, was to see Colin, you know, as a kid and you know him growing up, and then for him to then become my coach in 1995, 96 was just, amazing for me. And, we had some fun times over there in Tampa, in America, which he used to have a house at, and we had some great times.
Without accusing him of being Chris Akabusi, he's very often got a big smile on his face. Is that what he's like away from the cameras and the microphones, Jamie?
Oh, he can be very serious. Colin can be a very serious character. Yes, no, very serious. He can be very harsh as well, but fair.
Oh, I'm glad you said fair at the end of it, because otherwise I'd set you another schedule.
And I see him now, of course, and he's bringing us the benefit of his knowledge on a TV screen. I sometimes wonder whether he might be better directed coaching young athletes, because clearly there's an awful lot of knowledge and experience in that mind and in that body. What's your feeling, Jamie?
Colin's one of these people who's quite irritating, because he's just bloody good at everything. You know, he's one of those people who he can coach, he can do the TV, he can do the radio, he can do, you know, everything perfectly. And it does get a little bit irritating now and then. But the one thing he can't do is jog very far. He's useless at jogging.
He's not lying.
And we also hear he's a terrible swimmer, so we're starting to get down to it now. And Jamie, your hair was always much better, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely. Let me talk to you about some swimming now, which was really...
Go on, then.
Now you've got me a story here. We were on Superstars about 6-7 years ago, and I knew in Tampa in Florida, Colin was a useless swimmer, because I used to see him in his swimming pool and whatnot. Next thing you know, he's doing Superstars live on TV, and it was rumoured that Mark Foster had been coaching him, and I thought, ooh, okay, Mark Foster, if he's going to go on TV, he's bound to be good.
Big improvement,
He dives into the swimming pool with an Olympic dive. It was amazing. You know, he even bucked as he was, like, entering the pool. And he did, you know, that thing where, you know, the proper real swimmers do that dolphin kick.
Very good, yeah.
Well, usually they'll do it for 4 or 5 kicks. Colin did it for the whole of the 25-metre pool. And the classic moment, he did a tumble to him, but we didn't realise is everyone had finished, right? And I'll never forget, when Colin gets out of the pool, he can last badly, right? He gets out of the pool and the cameraman says, Colin, can we get you diving again? Because that's the only bit we saw you get in. Classic moment.
Well, Jamie, thank you for reminding us that he's not Superman after all.
No.
And thank you very much for joining us here. And he'll say thanks if he can stop laughing.
Cheers, buddy.
That's Jamie Balch, of course, a great 400-metre runner in his own right, bringing us to almost to the very end of what has been both an informative and tremendously entertaining edition of My Sporting Life. Colin, you're still a very young man, 45 years of age?
46 now.
46 years of age.
Yeah.
Very fit still. You look like you could run pretty happily if you wanted to, though one never knows about the knees and hips. Long way to go yet, I hope, in the life of Colin Jackson. What are your own hopes for the future? What do you see yourself doing, and what do you hope for things to happen around
you? Do you know what? I've just kind of set up a new event called Go Dad Run, which is trying to get guys to think about their health. Right. So I came to that stage in my life where, you know, you were super fit when you were on, and now you come to that period when you think, well, actually, I'm not as fit as I think I could be. So I've kind of set up this
Go Dad Run.
Go Dad Run. Yeah, Go Dad Run. And what I want guys to do is to go out there and run and compete. And when they're running, it's just to think why they're doing it. So I want them to be inspired and make sure that they go out there and get a proper health check. Because what's important to me is that men should talk about their health issues as women talk about their health issues, because it could save our life. It could keep us on this planet for 10 years
longer. It is extraordinarily difficult to get chaps to engage about that sort of thing,
isn't it?
It is really difficult.
Yeah. And that's why we want to try and make it as normalised as we possibly can. So the more events that are going on generally about that, and we can get the women in our lives to really start steering us and pushing us.
I take it as a
GoDadRun.com,
I'm guessing.
.co.uk.
Okay.
I'm British, so I'm GoDad.uk.
Okay, cool. And what about personally, Colin? What are you hoping for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's just about staying alive, staying healthy, enjoying life, motivated, inspiring as many people as I possibly can. And just ultimately stay good. That's what I want to be.
I'm watching your sister on Casualty in the year 2035.
Do you know what? It's lucky there's always DVDs. Girls get the box set.
You've been listening to an archive edition of Talk Sport's My Sporting Life with Danny Kelly. Thanks for listening. And make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast and Spotify for more top Talk Sport content.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.